Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on X Twitter, and of course, the VIP columnist and memoirist at RedState.com as well. So there you go.
Thanks, Ed. I always get such a chuckle out of that. Anytime, I feel down, I'm just going to go and click on the podcast and hear your introduction of me and boost my ego.
It should be boosted. I mean, that's what I think. I think we're boosting each other's egos on these things, and that's kind of the primary reason to do podcasts, frankly, I think.
Or to be
the host of CBS's Face the Nation. Did you watch Margaret Brennan?
No, I can't.
Interview Marco Rubio yesterday.
I can't abide her. I get the transcripts, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah, usually that's where I'm at too. Or if I see the clip, you know. But I did watch a little bit of that. And by the way, I have to send thank yous to Andrew, who keeps me in the loop on all these transcripts. So much appreciated. It's just the kind of guy that Andrew is. He's always looking out for his friends. I did see that, and I saw a bunch of buzz on it, you know, yesterday in the afternoon. I was wondering what that was about. So I took a look at the clip, and it's amazing to me that even in a situation this serious, right, where you've got the United States after 46 years of provocations from Iran deciding to directly strike their nuclear weapons development program to make sure that it is not going to be successful, that you've got Margaret Brennan haggling over whether or not Ali Khamenei actually gave the order to weaponize. And she said, that was the important question. He says, no, it wasn't. And it was like, I was there. You're supposed to be asking me about this. I will tell you what the important thing was. The important thing was is that he could have ordered the weaponization. It would have been done before we could have done anything about it. That's the important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose that there's a complex of reasons for this. A part of it, of course, is my perception that they're on the other side of a spectrum, and so that shapes everything they do, everything they read, everything they think of, and it's incurable. I mean, there's no way they could honestly evaluate some act by Donald Trump. But I don't understand how the corporate parents can abide it. I mean, this is the company. This used to be the gold standard when I was running around the world and the country. CBS was it. That was the it thing. And they had good people, smart people, clever people, and they would scoop you at the drop of without dropping anything. And I don't know how it got to this or why it stays this way. I thought, frankly, in my memory, of course, it's old memory, but I thought she was being replaced, but I could be wrong.
You know, I think that she was the replacement, right? She replaced John Dickerson.
She was yeah.
Yeah. Who is, I thought, did a pretty credible job in that position.
You remember who John Dickerson was?
He was the anchor, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he was the son of Nancy Dickerson.
No, I guess I don't know. Who's Nancy Dickerson?
Oh, she was the big Washington star, I think, for NBC for a long time, maybe CBS.
Oh, okay. But,
and so it runs in the family. So there's invisible corporate politics that go on at these places. And
true.
But putting in a vacuum brain like that is just... I suppose it could be staff, and she's just a not very pretty face that they put out there to ask the questions that are on her teleprompter. But gosh, you're right. It's embarrassing for what's supposed to be a premier news organization that's about to make a big payment to Donald Trump.
That's true. That's true. You know, that's one of the reasons why Scott Pelley is out.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
And, he'll be and remember Dan Rather? He's gone.
Oh, now, can we forget Dan Rather?
Yeah, he was a prince to me. I mean, he was wonderful. And he was the MC at a place where I spoke. And I mean, he's just wonderful. I don't know. Well, there's a lot of things I don't know. And one of them is how these places get so, well, it's corrupted, twisted. And it just goes on and on and on. It's not, I mean, I'm a human being, so I have opinions and thoughts, but as a professional news person in the old days, I could suppress them and do a fair treatment. And I've had colleagues come up to me afterwards and say, boy, I couldn't have done that. And I was kind of shocked because, well, isn't that what we're supposed to do? You know, but it isn't anymore.
Well, right. We're supposed to be accurate. You know, and just to give you an example, one of my colleagues, I was tweeting something out today about the LA Sheriff's Department, oh, right?
What's that? Thing about
the LA Sheriff's Office. Yeah, where they were, you know, thoughts and prayers go to the Iranian people. It's like, are you kidding me? First off, how is this anywhere in your sphere of anything?
Yeah.
But I tweeted out LASO, and one of my colleagues, and it's too late for me to edit it now, and it's kind of not worth going back and deleting and retweeting. But I used LASO, LA Sheriff's Office, when it's really LA Sheriff's Department. One of our colleagues, one of our mutual colleagues here in the town hall, you know, constellation of stars, reminded me of that. And she said, I don't mean to be picky. And I said, you're not being picky, you're being accurate. You know, I should know that. I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in an area where the LA Sheriff's Department was the law enforcement agency, because I grew up in, wasn't unincorporated, but the city. I grew up in Cerritos. Anybody who knows this area will know Cerritos. And Cerritos didn't have its own police department. I think they still don't, because they didn't want the expense of it. So, and it used to be a smaller place, and now it's filthy rich.
So they contract with the sheriff's department for the law enforcement services.
When I was growing up, it would say LA Sheriff's Department. Now they've got it private labeled for Cerritos Police, but it's really, I think it's still LASD. So I know it's supposed to be LASD, but I wrote LASO. And that, I mean, that's the type of detail that you really should know, especially if you grow up in that area. And I just didn't think about it. I was thinking office, so I said LASO. But I don't mind that kind of correction because I want to be accurate, right?
Yeah.
Whereas some of these wannabe celebrities who are masquerading as journalists just simply can't abide it. Now, not all of them are like that. Some of them are very welcoming to constructive criticism or just pointing out factual errors so they can go back and correct them. And I'm not going to go and name the people that I've done that with. I would say this: John Dickerson is one of them. He and I got into a colloquy, I guess you could call it, because it wasn't an argument, or it was a discussion, right? And he had said something about the Ninth Circuit, I think it was, and I had just written something about it. I tweeted over to him. I said, you know, it's not a big deal, but I think that the idea that the Ninth Circuit is, you know, way out of step with Supreme Court is actually overblown. I've looked at the data. Here's my post on it. And he wrote me back and he said, that's really an excellent post. He says, I never thought to look at it from that perspective. So I'll give John Dickerson some kudos on that. He's one of the guys that I actually, who could be engaged on that. But you get guys like Dan Rather, you know, Dan Rather is sort of legendarily a legend in his own mind anyway. But I mean, you got Margaret Brennan, who's sitting there talking to the guy who was in the room, and she's lecturing on him on what on what it was that drove the decision to bomb the Iranian nuclear facilities on Saturday evening in Rubio City. that wasn't it? And she's saying, yes, it was, as though she was in the room at the time. I mean, it's just amazing to me. Yeah. The hubris of that. It's probably not amazing to you because you lived with it for a long time.
And what's amazing that it happened, but also that it continues. That there aren't some smart editors over there, or bosses that go, you know, wait a minute. You can't do this. You can't look so stupid on TV because it affects our credibility, which it, to the extent that credibility remains with these people anymore. But anyway, it was a big story on the weekend. I had some questions. First of all, when the B2s took off for Guam, I tweeted, there's something fishy about this, because if you're going to Iran, it's twice as far to go through Guam as it is to just go east. But then, of course, it turned out that it was a head fake, that they all took off and refueled, and then some of them and some of them headed for Guam, and the flight trackers reported it. And then others ducked off and went to do the real work. But number one, and see, if I was an editor, this is what I would have insisted what go be inserted into the story, is I thought these planes were stealth. So how could anybody be tracking stealth planes and alleging that they were going to Guam in the first place? Second, how could you, if you are tracking them for real, how could you miss that most of them turned and went the other way? What is it that the National Inquiring Minds want to know? I mean, it's just one of those questions that comes up that so often now with media, where you read something and you go, wait a minute, why didn't they ask this question? And they don't.
Well, I'll say this. I think that I think what they were tracking was the refueling planes that were flying with them.
Which you could fake. I mean, you put
which,
over.
Which they probably did. Because I think those guys could fly into, because they had, don't forget, like a week earlier or so, they had sent a bunch of refueling planes to Europe, right? So I'm pretty sure those B2s can get to Europe and catch a refueling flight someplace over the Mediterranean to do their business.
I thought we had B2s on Diego Garcia, which
we did originally. We did for a while. In March, they moved into Diego Garcia. They moved them out in April when Iran agreed to start negotiating.
Fascinating story. And now that Iran is bombing in Qatar, that'll make a lot of Arab friends for Iran. You're going after other Arab countries. You know, one of the things that intrigued me when I was in Dubai was, and this isn't just manners. This is part of their, well, at least in the Emirates, in the UAE, hospitality. I mean, you could hate somebody, absolutely hate them, and yet you're going to treat them as the most gracious host you could imagine. I mean, it's just a part of the culture. And they don't do it to be obsequious or whatever. I've seen them. They had people there in the Emirates from, and of course their job historically, their stick was that they deal with everybody because they were traders but you know, Oman was there, and Oman is not a friend of the Emirates, and yet Oman was being treated graciously, was at the luncheon that where I was, and anyway. So I can't imagine that Qatar would welcome Iran bombing in Qatar and embarrassing them as hosts of the Americans, whether you like them being there or not. I mean, it wasn't Iran that was complaining that Israel so cleverly had mined the guest room where one of the Hamas leaders was going to be, and then
yes.
and then set it off so that Iran was well, he was dead, but Iran was embarrassed.
I'm so unhappy that they were embarrassed, you know.
Let me
ask you this, because I think you're bringing up a good point, right? And my read on this situation is that the Qataris kind of set this up as kabuki theater. The Iranians, there was a lot of reporting on this, or a lot of chatter, at least I should say, is that the Iranians had arranged this with Qatar as a more or less a demonstration attack. And they gave them a heads up. I don't know if they did that with Bahrain or Iraq, because there were missiles that were shot in those directions too. But with Qatar, they gave them a heads up what was coming, when it was coming. And I mean, Qatar, an hour, maybe longer than that, before the attack actually took place, had closed its airspace. And so we knew something was up, right? And the U.S. embassy in Qatar, before that, had told all American personnel to shelter in place until further notice. So clearly somebody knew something. But the idea was that Iran could then have a face-saving response to what happened at Fordo and Natanz and Isfahan on Saturday without escalating matters any further. And then say, okay, now we're ready to start negotiating an end to this thing. It would depend on Donald Trump not taking the bait, though. And I'm not sure how inclined he is to let that slide, but we'll see. It was interesting, though, that Iran claimed they only fired the same number of missiles that the U.S. dropped on Fordo, which was, I think, either 12 or 14. And that was their response to what happened.
Proportionate.
Yeah.
You know, I have an intimate I have a familial relationship with someone who was assigned at CENTCOM during the first Trump administration. And you may remember Iran shot down one of our drones in the Straits of Hormuz. And there was a retaliatory attack set up, and the American planes, I think from Saudi, were on their way to wipe out some radar stations when Donald Trump said to the Pentagon, by the way, how many casualties do you anticipate from this? And the Pentagon said 150 to 200 on the ground. And he canceled in flight the retaliatory attack. He said it was disproportionate to losing an unmanned drone. So,
yeah,
these things go on. Trump doesn't get any credit for this, but there's 150 or 200 people alive now who would not have been. And, you know, one of the things that intrigues me about this story is, of course, there was, and understandably, great excitement and jubilation over finally, the Americans doing something to to stall for hopefully a long period of time the weapons development program. But then on Sunday, Vance revealed that the storage facilities, which I think were at Isfahan, they're fine. I mean, there were tomahawks that hit it, but the reports beforehand were that Iran had 60 or 70% of the enriched uranium that it needed for a dozen weapons. That doesn't sound like a great hoop.
I'm not sure if fine in the context of what Vance was saying means that it's still accessible. I think he might have meant that it wasn't leaking. Because the big concern was, of course, if you blow open those containments, you're going to have radioactive material all over the place. It's a huge problem. But because that was part of the underground stuff at Isfahan, right? Yeah. Fordo too. Fordo has the same issue. And I think saying.
If it's underground and you need bunker busters, and why are you sending Tomahawks? There's just some things, unanswered questions out there that.
Well, absolutely. And I think we're going to.
Inquiring mind.
We're going to be spending a lot of time over the next several days trying to figure out how much of that they took out. At least at Fordo, the IAEA came out today and said it's probably gone. I mean, we're not there on the ground, but based on what we were seeing from the satellite photos and based on what we're seeing from the seismometers that they have installed in those places, it's likely that any production capability in Fordo is destroyed. Even if the whole thing hasn't caved in on itself, those centrifuge cascades are incredibly delicate. It can't be moved around, you know? So that thing got shook up a lot. They're probably all destroyed.
So we were moving them around. Remember in the Stuxnet, the Stuxnet attack set them back for a year or whatever. they sent all the centrifuges spinning into oblivion, but they had masked the alarms. So the engineers are sitting there thinking everything's going fine when in fact they're all destroying themselves. It's a big story and it's going on, and I imagine there will need to be further action.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the case. Maybe not. It depends on, you know, there were some indications today that the Iranians were jamming navigational signals in the Straits of Hormuz, which is a soft way of trying to close that strait. And two Chinese tankers had to turn around. So China wasn't very happy about that. And they said that they made a statement to the effect of, we've been in contact with Iran about the situation, which is basically probably to telling them, knock it off.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I don't know if there's really going to be a lot of room for negotiation because the Israelis aren't in the mood to negotiate. They've got these guys on the ropes. They want to knock them out.
Nor should they be. I mean, I think we're kind of past the time now. Well, maybe we won't attack him. Well, yeah, we will. I mean, finish it off. We don't have a reputation as the United States for finishing things off. Starting them, yeah. But finishing them, not always so well. And I hope we do this time, or that Israel does for us.
By the way, I don't know if you saw this, but Trump has responded to the Iranian attack, not with another attack, not with retaliation, but on Truth Social, which is, of course, his platform of choice. Let me read this off to you, at least part of this. Iran has officially responded to our obliteration of the nuclear facilities with a very weak response, which we expected and have effectively countered. There have been 14 missiles fired, 13 were knocked down, and one was set free because it was headed in a non-threatening direction. I am pleased to report that no Americans were harmed, and hardly any damage was done. More importantly, they've got it all out of their system, and there will hopefully be no further hate. I want to thank Iran for giving us early notice, which made it possible for no lives to be lost and nobody to be injured. Perhaps Iran can now proceed to peace and harmony in the region, and I will enthusiastically encourage Israel to do the same. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah,
it's like that was nice. Good retaliation, guys.
Yeah. Nice try. Moving on.
Yes, did you get it all out of your system now?
In other world news, yeah.
So we'll see. So I would imagine we're not going to do anything else.
Yeah. What the attack also showed, and this was the column yesterday, was, a more mature, savvy Trump.
Yep.
And not just on the attack, but leading up to it. And he had a wonderful quote, which I used in the column, and I don't have in front of me, but it was, look, I don't want to fight. I'm not looking for a fight. But if they're insisting on getting nuclear weapons, you got to do what you got to do. And, you know, I think most Americans, even if they don't like them, it made sense. It made sense. And it wasn't Trump pounding on the table. Of course, he doesn't pound on the table, but it wasn't Trump shooting off his mouth like he might have done in 2015 with demeaning nicknames for people, Tiny Hands, Rubio, and all of that stuff. It was Trump being open and communicating clearly the way he has always done. I mean, there could be little doubt. He might be a head fake, but you can be little doubt that what Trump says he means. And, you know, whether you like him or not, that's very helpful in a national leader. And I think a lot of people have bought into that. Joe Biden wouldn't know what day of the week it was. And you might not like what Trump was doing or saying, but you got his message. He's a good communicator. And I really like that.
Well, it also comes as the Democrats were doing this whole taco thing, right? Trump always chickens out. Yeah. Chuck Schumer was saying, why is Trump negotiating with Iran? Is there a side deal? We need to know. Taco Trump is going to give away the store and blah, 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 blah. And that was just a couple weeks ago. And immediately after the mission was announced, people started tweeting back at Chuck Schumer saying, this didn't age well.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is that it's true that Trump likes to bluster. I mean, it's true. Trump likes to bluster. And on things like tariffs, he does do that. He throws them out there, then he'll back off, then he'll throw them out there again, and he'll back off. He's negotiating, but that is different than national security, right? That's a financial deal. And look, I'm not a fan of tariffs. I don't know that this is really the right direction to go. I understand what he's trying to do. I think there's better ways to go about it. But that being said, this is how he makes deals. He gives maximalist, sort of demands, and then waits to see what the response is, and he kind of pulls it back. And then if they're still not engaging seriously, or in his mind anyway, he'll toss out more maximalist demands. I mean, so yes, chickening out, no. But basically, this is the way the guy negotiates. And he did this all during the first term, too. This is not new. But these guys just needed a meme, so they came up with Taco. Trump always chickens out. Well, now they're angry because he didn't chicken out.
Yeah. So, remember, in the first term, let's see, Trump was the fourth or fifth U.S. president to try to get a meeting and get the North Korean leader to meet with the West and at least talk about it, about his nuclear program. And Trump, with bluster, moving two nuclear carrier groups into the region, and we don't know what else was there. And you remember Little Rocket Man and all of that stuff. And guess what? Kim came out and met with him, not once, but twice. And while he was meeting, he stopped his tests, which set them back a little bit. So, some bluster does work. And I don't care if it's good for his ego. I imagine some presidents really like to hear hail to the chief when they walk in the room and everybody stands up. That wouldn't be my thing, but okay.
That's because that's why you're not president. It's not my thing either. It's why I'm not president.
and you need a big hat if you're going to be Pope. So,
that's true.
Yeah.
Hail to the Pope. He's the Pope and he needs hailing. Hail to the Pope. He's the Pope and he needs hailing.
And I don't know whether you'd ever be up to wearing a White Sox hat.
No, never. See, so there you go. It's, I'm disqualified in so many different ways from that position. And I think they picked the right guy for this time around too. So I'm not worried about it. It's a great column, by the way, over at Red State. And also, I mean, we don't have a lot of time left here, but Also, you've got a new Malcolm's Memories up there, too. You posted that this morning. Train, Streetcars, and Grandma. Don't give it away. It's free. No. People can go over there and read it for free, but just give us a little taste.
Yeah. The memories, we're coming up on 36 of them, and they're all listed in each one of them, so you can pick and choose and wander through them. But I wrote one or two a long time ago, a couple of years ago, and Jennifer Van Laar, the editor at MedState, said, you should write these regularly. And so I did, and they've been very popular. This one was about parts of a childhood, which really seemed to my childhood, which much of which was spent in Canada, which really seemed to strike a resonant tone with a lot of people. So, I hope you'll go and look at it and maybe wander through some of the others listed at the bottom. But it's fun to write these memories because, you know, if you live long enough, you know things that other people don't. And you remember things that other people don't know even happened. And that's one of the things I said that you retweeted. Thank you for that, Ed, today was I said, you know, I will forever be appreciative of William Carrier's invention and the refrigerated air of movie theaters back in the day. But in the hot summer nights, when I turned the pillow over to the cool side, I didn't realize it was such a burden. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, it's fun. Well, you know, writing needs to be fun. And
it does,
And if it's fun writing, I had a friend once, and he said, do you like to write? And he said, no. Well, I like having written. And there is a big difference in that because writing can be, if you work at it, it can be hard work. But when you get the responses like these memories do, it makes it all worthwhile because you touch a common theme with people and they respond. And they, as many have in the comments, and they shared their memories of childhood and mine were. Circled around trains and transportation in those days. But so, yeah. Well, thanks for mentioning it. And I hope people do go and check it out. Like you said, it's free.
It's free. Go check it out. Absolutely. Yeah, and these are excellent. If you haven't experienced these, they're all available at redstate.com. So go over there and check that out at redstate.com. It's a great series over there. And, sort of a serialized memoir, maybe. Andrew's written a few books.
I've written 10 and I've tried to write others, but publishers don't seem to want to pay for them anymore. So
no, it's tougher and tougher. That market's getting tougher and tougher. So we're just about at the end of our show, and you know what that means. It is time for
I have one.
So the week. I've got one too, so you go first.
All right. So there's a German who's driving in France, and he gets pulled over for speeding. And the French police officer comes up to him and says, what's your name? And he says, you know, Heinrich Schmidt. And he says, what's your age? And he says, 32. Asks him for his address, and he answers. And then he looks at the German, and he says, no, and the occupation? And the German says, no, not this time.
Well, there you go. All right. Here's mine. It's a little bit long. It says, farmer sitting in, and this is from jokesoftheday.net. I love going over there. They've got lots of funny jokes over there. Farmer was sitting in the neighborhood bar getting hammered. And one of his friends comes in and asks the farmer, why are you sitting here on this beautiful day getting drunk? The farmer shook his head and replied, you know, some things you just can't explain. And says, well, what do you mean? What happened? And the farmer says, well, today I was sitting by my cow milking her. Just as I got the bucket about full, she lifted her left leg and kicked over the bucket. Okay. So the friend says, but that's not so bad. Farmer says, nope, some things you just can't explain. He says, then I took her left leg and tied it to the post on the left. Okay. And then He says, well, then I sat back down and continued to milk her. Just as the bucket became about full, she took her right leg and kicked over the bucket. And the man laughed and said, again? And the farmer says, hey, some things you just can't explain. And this is, well, what did you do then? Farmer says, I took her right leg this time and tied it to the post on the right. And then I sat back down and began milking her again. And just as I got the bucket about full, the stupid cow knocked over the bucket with her tail. And the friend says, wow, okay. How did that happen? Farmer says, some things you just can't explain. And friend says, what'd you do then? He says, well, I didn't have any more rope, and I wanted to tie the tail to the rafters. So I took off my belt, tied her tail to the rafter. In that moment, my pants fell down to my ankles, and that's when my wife walked in. And I'm here to tell you some things you just can't explain.
Oh, hey-o. Oh, boy.
Some things you just can't explain.
Oh, yeah.
I like that one. I got to remember that one.
Timing.
Timing's everything. Timing. Yeah. Timing and pants that fit are everything.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, boy.
All right, Andrew. Well, on that note, I think we should probably wrap this one up, but we'll be back again next week to do another podcast here on the Ed Morrissey Show with the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on Twitter, and of course, RedState.com. Andrew, thanks for another fun one. I can't wait to do it again next week.
Okay, see you then, Ed. Thanks, everybody. See you then, too.